This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.
Welcome to Property Patter. My name is Emma Humphreys and I am a partner at Charles Russell Speechleys. I'm joined today by Richard Friendly, one of my colleagues in our real estate disputes team, and by Dan Moore, who's from our insolvency team. We're here to talk about the upcoming June quarter day, the expiry of certain changes to landlords' remedies, and the direction of travel which is being encouraged by government now. Richard, let's start with the exciting topic of the restrictions that the government has been introducing on various landlords' remedies. You and I talked back in May about those. Where are we at with those now? Let's start with forfeiture.
Well, in terms of where we were and where we are now with forfeiture, as we discussed last time, there were various steps put in place by the government after the pandemic started that were designed effectively to try to create a scenario where tenants could continue to operate even though they weren't really operating, and to keep their premises. The government seemed to perceive that there was a risk that landlords might forfeit leases, and so they brought in place a preventative step, preventing any commercial premises from being forfeit effectively up until the end of this month. That has now been extended. There was a lot of debate around whether it was going to affect commercial property or whether any extensions would be limited to residential, but that has been applied to commercial, such that the prevention on forfeiture is going to continue now until the end of September.
Right, so not great news for landlords, but I suspect many tenants are probably heaving a huge sigh of relief at that news. Was that something that we knew about in advance?
There was no real debate about it. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. The government's statements in the run-up to the end of last week all very much focused on residential property. So we knew that as far as residential property possession proceedings were concerned, there was going to be an extension of the previous stay and prevention of possession proceedings being pursued. That was originally, again, due to expire about now, was extended to the 23rd of August. All of the announcements this time around, much as they were actually back in March, were focused on housing and housing possession cases. Back in March, we had the stay brought in for the first time. That was, again, supposed to relate to housing cases, but was applied much more widely across the board. So pretty much affected any possession case. We were expecting a more sort of streamlined, trimmed down version of that so that it would just be housing. But now all of those extensions, including the extension on possession proceedings, have been applied across the board again. So, very much came out of the blue.
Maybe it's just that people and their housing tend to get the headlines for the politicians, or perhaps being a bit too cynical. I mean, last time we did our podcast about commercial property arrears and the changes, those restrictions that were originally introduced, you and I, of course, Richard, we spoke with Heidi from our insolvency team about the measures which the government had proposed to prevent landlords from pursuing statutory demands or winding up petitions against tenants who can't pay their rent due to COVID-19. Now, again, those restrictions were due to end at the end of June, but the bill containing them is being amended, I believe, to extend that period until the end of September. But nonetheless, we have this weird situation where the bill, much as the government keeps making announcements about it, the bill is still making its way through Parliament. It is not yet passed law. So what does that mean, Dan, for landlords who might be interested in using that route?
It's a very interesting scenario, actually, because the courts are actually interpreting the legislation as if it had already been enacted. So we were hoping it would be enacted perhaps by now. Realistically, I don't think it's going to be done before the end of June. But there are two cases already where the courts are saying, well, look, we can see this bill. It's going to become law very shortly in the form that the bill is currently in. And they're actually taking a fairly pragmatic approach and interpreting the provisions of it as if it was in force already, which is very unusual. But I think it's a sign of the times that we're in. The government has given a clear steer that they want the economy to promote rescue and be debtor friendly. So in this instance, in relation to tenants, for landlords, there is a glimmer of hope. as the courts have been interpreting the bill as if it's already been enacted. But I think ultimately they need to conduct a fact analysis of whether coronavirus has had a financial impact, or alternatively, whether prior to COVID-19, the tenant couldn't pay anyway. Those seem to be the key 2 points.
And I like the way you say it's a sign of the time. You managed to avoid saying the word unprecedented, which I'm sure is going to be coming up. and the other option that's been on hold about, you know, changes and the quick arrival of these changes. We also very recently had the announcement about CRA. Now, this has been on hold just, you know, obviously from a matter of practicality in many cases because of the closure of premises. Now we've got non-essential shops reopening. That's a remedy that some landlords have been considering. As I say, the government then announced that it's going to make some further changes here so that 189 days of rent is going to need to be owed before the remedy can be used. And again, I believe that change, which was due to expire at the end of June, is going to be enforced until the end of September. But what are the other considerations for landlords here in looking to use this remedy, do you think, Richard?
I mean, obviously, there's lots of things for landlords to think about. I think if we look back to where we were in sort of March and then when we spoke in May, we were sort of looking at that from a perspective of the fact that most premises were closed. It was very difficult for enforcement agents in practice to actually be able to exercise CRA on behalf of landlords in any event. So actually increasing the time period of arrears from 7 days to 90 days probably didn't make a huge amount of difference to landlords. The circumstances in which they'd have been able to recover by a CRA in any event was probably being very limited. Yeah. This obviously is a sea change on that. You mentioned the word unprecedented. We're starting to get close to that, I think, here, where we've seen that time period extend from 7 to 90 days and now up to 189 days. That really takes CRA off the table in a lot of circumstances, I suspect, for a lot of landlords. But where there are issues around the edges are, for example, where you've got service charge arrears. Service charge arrears are not within the CRA regime, and so there's a look to how you might recover those. When landlords do have circumstances, they can exercise CRA. So, for example, if the rent is more than 189 days owed, then in those circumstances, it's a question of looking at the premises, looking at what the most likely source of recovery is going to be. Is it a case where CRA might work? The notice period before actually exercising CRA, once you've established your 189 days, is quite short. And so there's a 7-day notice then that needs to be served before it can be exercised. Enforcement agents will need to be thinking about social distancing. Now, obviously, there's discussions at the moment around reducing the social distancing requirements from 2 metre down to 1 metre. That might make things easier. There's also question marks over who goods belong to. Are they the tenant's goods? Are they subtenant's goods? Are they others? Lots of thought processes that need to be gone through as part of that CRA exercise, but certainly the 189 days extension is going to be a bit of a blow for landlords.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, these changes that the government brings in, though, because I think you're right as well. I think there's going to be some really interesting issues now that get looked at with CRA that haven't really been bothered with before, things like the service of the notice. You know, when you're dealing with people who are on furlough, offices not necessarily open, that sort of thing. You know, it's going to be quite interesting, isn't it? And thinking back to forfeiture that we were talking about, obviously, you know, they've extended the moratorium on forfeiture, but actually, you know, many landlords in the current market won't be thinking about forfeiting because who are they going to relet to? So CRA is a sort of next obvious step. You know, there's still a relationship there and there's still that need for dialogue, really, isn't there?
Certainly is. And I think we can't forget about the fact that there are other enforcement methods that still can be used for landlords. So just because the traditional self-help remedies of CRA and forfeiture are not available, court proceedings are still for recovery of debt, still perfectly within the scheme of opportunity that landlords have for recovering arrears and for securing their financial position. There are talks within particularly the retail and casual dining industries of a number of the big operators who are facing potential debt recovery actions of trying to defend those actions on the grounds that there is a great scheme policy by this government to try to assist tenants, and that therefore the using debt recovery proceedings is inconsistent with that general policy message. Well, I'm not sure how that's going to get on, but there's a lots of interesting issues around that. But at the moment, at least, those other tools are still usable and good way of putting pressure on tenants if landlords feel the need to do so at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, CRAR is still available in certain circumstances. We should be clear that forfeiture is off the table, but CRAR is just, it's really become a remedy that people just, landlords are going to need to look at more carefully than perhaps they're used to.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and sometimes it may still be the right remedy, mightn't it?
Completely agree. It's not that it's not something to consider. It should be considered. I just think it's just going to need to be considered in the round as to whether in that particular set of circumstances it's either appropriate or possible. It will all depend on the underlying factual basis.
I should add, just in relation to CRAR, there can be an interesting interplay between the CRAR regime and insolvency processes, whereby subject to timings of the CRAR notices and how far progressed that enforcement process is, and an insolvency starting or commencing, there may be some collateral advantage for a landlord in those scenarios, whereby they may be able to take an asset and sell it and realise the proceeds prior to an insolvency, which would put them effectively ahead of the queue compared to other creditors in an insolvency scenario. So although the use of CRAR may be slim or limited, it's always one to still consider.
And I think it's fair to say that, you know, we've been thinking about landlords and the remedies available to them. We've continued to see a variety of approaches from tenants, but I think there are still a number who are not communicating with their landlords. Do you think, Dan, that that may be because they're preparing to use an insolvency process? What options are going to be available to them before the June quarter day?
I think there is a concern that the silence from tenants does indicate that they are potentially looking at insolvency processes. I know back in March when the lockdown started, realistically, it was probably just a situation of they were so shocked, their trading had been completely disrupted. So any silence between tenants and landlord could probably be easily explained. But now we're into June and everyone's familiar with broadly what's going on. I think landlords should be looking very, very closely at communications with tenants. Who is simply not communicating at all? Those that are communicating, what are you being told? I've seen over the last week three CVA proposals. So there have been some interesting ones in the press, obviously the All Saints one, which has been recognised in Canada and other jurisdictions. So I think we're going to see an increase in company voluntary arrangements, CVAs, especially in that landlord-tenant dynamic where, especially in the retail scenario, you've got distressed businesses that were distressed and now are severely distressed. So I think landlords have to be on the front foot. They have to have a proper understanding of their real estate portfolio now, where there is likely to be exposure to distressed tenants. I mean, that should be already well known. You can probably look back at the history of the relationship and actually the business and the pattern of trading. You'll have a good idea of who the potential CVA stroke administration candidates will be. I think in terms of what they can do, they need to be ready to jump on any proposals as soon as they become aware of them. They need to take advice. They need to have just simple things, practical things like having their documents in order, so they're ready to go and ready to decide whether the CVA proposal or an administration proposal is beneficial to them, whether they can challenge it in any way. These things happen very quickly, so it's good to be on the front foot. But in terms of actual hard things they can do, liquidation, winding up petitions, it's all been paused, CRAR regime's limited, so it's a lot of commercial stuff trying to be ready.
It's a good point you raise, actually, because although you say, you know, there's some simple things they can do to get prepared, get organised, get the paperwork together. Of course, in the current climate, depending on, you know, the particular arrangements, IT arrangements and things that landlords have, that sometimes that's going to be easier than others, actually. I mean, again, we are in unprecedented times, and whereas people might have just called on a particular system to bring up, all the tenancy documents or whatever it might be, again, I'm seeing a variety of levels of organisation. I don't know about you, Richard, but I'm not sure everyone can lay their hands on every piece of paper.
But undoubtedly not.
Yeah, I'm glad we've got e-filing, let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
Another good point you raised there, Dan, is about the cooperation between landlords and tenants, actually, and understanding your tenants, you knowing their position, knowing historically, you know, how have they traded and that sort of thing, because we now have this new government code for landlords and tenants to guide them in their negotiations about dealing with the current arrears situation. And that includes reference to actually how have tenants complied with their lease in the past. It does help, you know, it does contain a few helpful points of clarification, including the government's view that tenants should prioritise the payment of service charges and insurance. And we've been talking about how CRA isn't available for service charges and things other than pure rent. But nonetheless, the remainder of the code, which I've been looking at and we've all been looking at, seems to me to be teaching the property industry to suck eggs. Richard, do you agree with that, or am I being too harsh? Do you think this code's going to have any effect at all now we've had it published?
I largely agree with you, I think, Emma. I think the issue with codes is that it very much depends on the amount of sort of almost legal effect that they carry with them. Those that are more advisory, like this one, tend to have a mixed reaction within the market generally. I think there are some useful things in there, as you said. The comments regarding service charges and insurance are interesting and probably helpful to some tenants to help them be able to prioritise their payments a little bit and think through how they might manage the process from where they are now to where they're likely to need to be within the next couple of months. But that said, a lot of what you'll find here is information that most, particularly relatively experienced parts of the property industry already know. It also has quite a lot of the hallmarks of some of the guidance that has flown out of the government's policy machine over the last few months in any event. Some of the statements about trying to pay what you can and trying to manage things as best you can. Well, but ultimately, obviously, everybody knows that they're under an obligation to do that. It's a question of whether that's actually what's going to happen in practice. Or are we actually going to find a wider tenancy position where tenants are effectively saying, well, we don't think we can pay anything because our market is so uncertain. And so therefore, we'll just run the risk of action from our landlords, whether that's going to lead to good dialogue or not, whether landlords are going to take the sort of same approach that they took largely in March and April. Will they continue to want to try to reach agreement, or have they reached a point now where the cash flow is such an issue for them with not receiving the payments in that they need, that they're going to need to start becoming more aggressive, in which case this code might not necessarily particularly help or remedy that situation.
Yeah, and it doesn't give landlords any reassurance either, which perhaps just is not possible to do. But you know, the landlords who do accommodate their tenants and, you know, are flexible, the problem is you're dealing with, you know, quite a big industry, isn't it, and there's, yeah, other landlords and tenants doing different things and what have you, and it's trying to balance it all together, and there's no reassurance for landlords that if they accommodate that tenant that actually that's going to put them in a good position. Yeah. You know, if the tenant does later become insolvent, on the whole, you know, they'll be unsecured creditors, won't they?
Absolutely.
You know, it is going to be interesting to see how landlords and tenants treat the code. I know the government's going to monitor how landlords and tenants behave, so they will need to bear in mind that if they don't cooperate and the government finds itself having to go further and legislate, often the legislation we end up with is not ideal either. I mean, thinking about we've had the Electronic Communications Code, don't even get me started. having looked at the bill, which Dan is no doubt analysing in great detail, the draft Corporate Insolvency and Governance Bill, I'd say there's work for some improvement on that as well. Thank you very much, guys. It's been a really great run through of where things stand now for landlords and tenants at the moment. These are, as we said, unprecedented times. And I do apologise to our listeners for the fact that at the rate at which the law is changing at the moment, there may well have been further developments by the time you listen to this podcast. Please do check out our website for updates on these developments. We have a COVID-19 area where any recent changes in the law are reported, so you can bring yourselves nicely up to date. If you'd like to know a bit more about the Arrears Code or any of the other topics covered in this or any other podcast, please do get in touch with any of us. In the meantime, stay safe and thanks for joining us.
This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.